This is CJ Kilmer, and because of Ron Paul, I went down a much more radical path than I was on that eventually led me to starting the Dangerous History Podcast.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
The Other and Ron Paul Podcast starts now. Welcome to the Honor and Ron Paul Podcast, and with me today is Professor CJ, or CJ Kilmer. He has one of the best history podcasts out there, and is gaining quite a bit of traction. It's the Dangerous History Podcast, and I brought him on today, and he's been gracious enough to join this little tiny podcast about Honor and Ron Paul. Brought him on today to kind of talk about the importance of understanding history, his experiences with the Ron Paul movement, and just his podcast in general. So CJ, if you wouldn't mind, if we could just kind of start a little bit earlier on, before Ron Paul, kind of where were you politically?
I was some sort of a vague conservatarian, I would say. I was, or maybe a moderate libertarian with still a few kind of right-wing conservative views on a few things. But I was raised in a family that's mostly right-wing, and my mom's family are sort of moderate Republicans for the most part, and then my dad's family are more right-wing Republicans. And so that's what I grew up in. And I started, by the time I was a teenager, I started to have some doubts and some issues with some aspects of conservatism. And part of it was I decided that I wasn't into religion and didn't believe in any of it at a pretty early age. And that kind of alienated me from a lot of conservatism, because so much of it is, you know, based on that kind of theocratic idea. And then the other thing that really early on I started to have issues with was the war on drugs. Something about the war on drugs just, I could tell it was BS, you know, pretty early on. And so, you know, I read some Ayn Rand. I didn't buy entirely into Ayn Rand, but I definitely thought she made some valid points. And then I was, you know, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of, like, I don't know, maybe a typical Milton Friedman libertarian, something like that, a vaguely sort of conservative libertarian, maybe a better read, more articulate and informed version of Gary Johnson or something like that.
Okay.
And that's kind of where I was hanging out before the Ron Paul campaigns.
Okay. So you were fertile ground for the message when that all came out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was probably like, you know, an ideal target audience for that message, because I was already part of the way there. But, you know, it definitely helped bring me to be much more consistent in my views. And I mean, it eventually led me to being flat out anarchist. But at the time, the most important thing I think about the Ron Paul movement on my thinking was that it led me to be more consistent in my anti-war views, because I had some anti-war views and some anti-war instincts and some skepticism of a lot of the wars and the CIA and whatever, but they weren't really worked out and consistent and systematic. And I still, you know, thought that at least some of the wars America had been in were, you know, justified or necessary or whatever like that. And now I don't think that at all. So Ron Paul and the whole Ron Paul movement was an important kind of bridge for helping me to work those things out. And the other thing that Ron Paul did that was important in my intellectual development was sort of pointing me in the direction of things like Austrian economics and, you know, the more radical libertarianism of people like Rothbard in particular, who was a big influence on me. Mm-hmm. And Rothbard was somebody I don't think I had come across in all of my readings before. I was familiar with a lot of the other big names of libertarianism. I had read a fair number of their books since I was a teenager and whatever. But somehow, for whatever reason, I don't think I had bumped into Rothbard. So that was a that was a giant deal. The fact that I started to look at economics differently, instead of just having sort of vague free market instincts, having a, you know, things like an understanding of the business cycle, an understanding of what banking really is, all that sort of stuff, and then encountering not just the economics, but all the other stuff of Rothbard in particular, you know, some of his views on history, some of his views on sort of, you know, libertarian philosophy more abstractly and all that. So that Ron Paul was definitely the funnel into that stuff.
Right. Yeah. And for listeners, if they want to dig into some Rothbard, what would you recommend? I guess things that come to my mind of, you know, the people want to keep it short, Anatomy of the State, to really distill down. I guess that, you know, might scare some people off. And For a New Liberty, I found to be very accessible. What do you think as far as people diving into Rothbard?
Yeah, those are both great. I often recommend Anatomy of the State. And in fact, and this just shows you like how radical of stuff I can sometimes get away with at my day job teaching. When I teach World Civ II, which is world history since 1600, I typically will have my students' very first reading assignment, before I ask them to read anything in the textbook or anything else, the very first reading assignment, I have them read Anatomy of the State, because the overarching theme of the way I teach World Civ II is the rise of the modern nation state as an institution that eventually, you know, kind of takes over the whole world.
Right.
And obviously I do it from a mostly critical point of view, but, you know, the point is, like, even if a student isn't critical of the state at all, they'll at least learn the history of where this thing came from and how it became what it was. So anyway, I'll have my students read Anatomy of the State, and then we'll have a discussion about it. And it's one of those things where it's like, some people need to be bludgeoned right off the bat with something pretty radical that really rattles their paradigm a bit. And I know I've needed that at various points, to be told things that seem to be like so outside the mainstream and whatever, that at first you kind of go like, oh, that can't, you're crazy, right? But but there's a certain type of person, which I guess I'm one of them, that has enough intellectual openness and curiosity that when you're presented with a view that seems like wildly against the mainstream, I'll at least, even if at first I'm kind of like, that sounds crazy, I'll at least give it a hearing. Now, sometimes I'll decide like, no, I'm pretty sure this actually is crazy. but every now and then, there's one that isn't crazy when you actually kind of work it out and look into it. So yeah, Anatomy of the State is good. War, Peace, and the State is good. Mm-hmm. And then kind of depending on what specifically someone is interested in or has a background, and there's some others, you know, someone who's interested in economics, some of those shorter ones he did that just sort of talk about, like, you know, what money is and how the banking system works, and the titles are not coming to my mind right now, but I know there's some pretty good short ones about, like, the origins of the Federal Reserve and
what has government done to our money?
Yeah, there you go. That's one. Yeah. Yeah. So it kind of depends on the angle from which someone is approaching it and what their background is. But yeah, War, Peace, and the State is good for someone who's got more of an interest in that kind of thing.
Yeah. So going back, you mentioned a lot of your family is Christian conservative. Did anyone come along with you on this ride, or did it create strife, or are they just like, well, that's CJ, he can do what he wants?
It's one of those things that probably many people have encountered, where sometimes you'll have a conversation with a family member and you'll be trying to convince them of your point of view, and you'll be having a conversation, and in that conversation that day, you're basically, it seems like you're basically converting them, because, you know, let's say you're going about it in a very non-confrontational way. You're keeping it just kind of on a calm, inquisitive level, and they're going along with you, and they're like, oh, I didn't know that. Oh, wow, I didn't know that about the Federal Reserve. Huh.
Oh, interesting. Sure.
Yeah. I didn't know that about, you know, some dirty operation the CIA did that created blowback or whatever it is, right? And for that day, you get the illusion of like, oh, I'm really converting this person. And then you don't see that family member for a while. And then the next time you're around them, they're just like, you know, spouting off the same old Sean Hannity talking points they were before. So I don't know. People, a lot of times people will just seemingly, I don't know. It's like water off a duck's back. Even if at the time you're having a conversation, you seem to be winning them over. And it just all goes away sometimes. And it seems like there's something about close family members where they're particularly likely to have that response. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's a friend or acquaintance, it's actually, at least my experience anyway, it seems like it's more likely to have a lasting impact, even if it just is to raise a few doubts in their mind and make them rethink a couple of things. So
right.
No, I don't think I've really converted any of my family members away from what they were before. And I guess it's that classic sort of thing, right? That a prophet is never appreciated in his own hometown.
Sure. And I think a lot of it also has to do with, rational ignorance. And they kind of talk about that with the voters. I mean, it makes complete sense that people, since they have so little impact on the government, so little impact on how the world works at a functional level, why even bother learning and digging into it? Most people just want to live their lives and they don't really care about the underpinnings of, moral codes and how that may apply to the political class. And I can't blame them.
I
would probably be happier if I didn't go down this rabbit hole. Yeah, just kind of like, go Trump. I can't believe Trump. Whichever side I'd end up on.
I agree with you. Like, I don't blame them for not, if it's just something they're not interested in. I sit around and read books on history and economics and philosophy and whatever all the time because I enjoy it. So I don't blame someone if that's just not what they're into. The problem I have is that people who have done little or no serious looking into these things, little or no real research and thinking and, really trying to figure these things out, have just as strong of opinions, if not more so, right, as the people who actually have seriously done research and thinking and everything. I mean, it's, the way I see it, it's like, I don't follow professional sports of any sort at all. It's just not something I'm interested in, and I'm not putting down anyone who's into that. I mean, I'm sure I've got hobbies and interests that other people find weird or just don't know how anyone could be interested in it. But the point is, I don't walk around spouting off really strong opinions on, right, like what's going on in the NFL or what's going on in Major League Baseball or whatever. I don't have an opinion, and I'm happy to, if someone asks me my opinion, I'm happy to tell them I don't know. I don't follow that. I'm not interested. So I don't have an informed opinion. And I just wish that people would be the same way when it comes to things like politics and economics and whatever. Just if you really don't know what you're talking about, just say so. And don't have these ridiculously strong opinions where you'll yell at someone and lose your mind and start name calling and whatever. And it's things that you don't even actually have any real knowledge of.
Right. Yeah, that's an excellent point. It is interesting how, personal those political affiliations have kind of become. So tell me a little bit, moving on to your study of history, and then what level are you teaching right now? Do you just fold that into the podcast?
Well, I got a bachelor's degree in history with a minor in political science, and then I went on and got a master's degree in history as well. For a variety of reasons, I did not decide to continue on to a PhD. I was sort of like preemptively pre-accepted into the PhD program at the University of Tennessee, where I got my master's degree. Basically, my MA committee kind of said like, oh, yeah, you're basically, just a walk-on into the PhD program. It's like, it's a done deal. But for several reasons, some of them family related, I decided to not do that at that point. So I've got basically, because academia is a very rigid caste sort of a system, I've got basically the highest level job you can get if you have a master's degree in something, but no PhD. And that is, I have a full-time teaching position at a state college, which is what used to be called a community college. So it's a small college that mostly has 2-year degrees, does have a couple of bachelor's degrees now, but vast majority of the students are, you know, looking to either get an associate's degree or just take some credits and then transfer to a larger university to finish up. So yeah, basically what I am is a full-time community college professor. And so I'm teaching college, but I'm mostly teaching intro level survey courses, like just basic U.S. History 1 and 2, World History 1 and 2. And so my classes that I teach, I do a fair amount of like stuff you're not going to hear in a typical history course. I mean, you know, the typical history course in college, no matter where you go, is about a 95% chance it's taught by some sort of center left progressive. And I cover all kinds of things, including, you know, I mentioned I have my students read Murray Rothbard on some occasions. In U.S. History 2, I always have my students read, and then we discuss War is a Racket by Smedley Butler. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I cover things you don't normally hear about in a basic college history class. Like, I talk about a lot of the CIA's covert operations in the 20th century, you know, Operation Ajax and all those other sorts of things. When there's time, I even talk a bit about, you know, MK Ultra, COINTELPRO, mm-hmm. all these sorts of things. And so the classes I teach, they're like, in a way, they're like the light version of the podcast, because I am mentioning a lot of the same topics and I am coming at it from a pretty radical point of view, but I don't go quite as radical quite as often as I do on my show, because it's right. sort of a different situation. It's sort of a different, you know, audience and whatever. It's largely an involuntary audience who are only in that class, most of them, because they're checking off a gen ed credit.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not like people who seek out my podcast who, like, that's what they're looking for. And then the other thing is time. You know, I've got the students for 3 hours a week for 15 weeks in a course, right? And so, like, when I covered the Civil War on my podcast, I put out something like 28 hours worth of material on the Civil War. Yeah. So there is no way that would be a whole semester, basically,
right.
of class. And in a class where you're supposed to cover like from the colonial period up through the Civil War, obviously you can't spend 90% of the semester just digging into every nitty gritty detail in the Civil War. Or right now I'm working on a Woodrow Wilson series, and we were talking about it before you started recording. I'm on part 4. I'm guesstimating I'll probably have well over a dozen parts in the series before it's over, possibly, you know, as high as 20. So, you know, in my class, I might talk about Woodrow Wilson's presidency for like a couple of hours.
Right.
Whereas in the podcast, I might do 2 hours just on one episode about one aspect of his life or one aspect of his presidency. So the podcast is much more deep, you know, much more going into one of the slogans that I came up with lately, somewhat inspired by a listener comment, is I dive down the deepest, darkest rabbit holes so you don't have to.
That's good. Yeah, it definitely is a deep dive, and I strongly encourage anybody to add that to their subscriptions on their podcast app. So what do you mainly do? American history? This is going to come from a bit of ignorance because I'm a recent listener to Dangerous History, but it seems like the majority of it is American most recently.
Yes.
I haven't dug back in the prior archives, but is American history your main your main emphasis?
It's been that way, and it's been more that way lately with the podcast. I did do more world history topics, I think, earlier on, and I did more stuff early on from more time periods. Like I did do some things from the ancient and medieval periods in history, and I'm sure I'll come back to some of that again in the future, because I am sort of interested in everything. But it's definitely been more American history than anything else, particularly the last few years. And part of it is responding to demand that oftentimes, particularly when it's a long multi-part series on a big topic in American history, like the Civil War or the Revolutionary War or now Woodrow Wilson, those episodes often get the most downloads for me. So part of it's just that. Mm-hmm. And I do have listeners all around the world, and some of them I've even met in person when they visited the States, and some of them I just know online. But that said, I mean, something like, I think, 80 to 90%, maybe something like that, last time I checked, of my audience are Americans. So, you know, presumably that's what they'd be the most interested in on average. And then the other thing is, in my teaching, because of student demand and the way the credits work and everything like that, I end up teaching more classes of U.S. history than I do of other things. So that means that I've had to, in order to kind of keep my classes interesting for me and not just do the exact same thing every semester, I tend to read more in American history just all the time. And so that's, you know, I actually in graduate school, my primary field was modern Europe with an emphasis on the British Empire. And my secondary field was American history. So, and that's actually something I want to get to eventually. And I have no idea when. It might be at least another year or two. I'm not sure. But I do have kind of hazily out there on the horizon that I would like to eventually do a really in-depth rise and fall of the British Empire sort of series that covers, you know, the whole thing, hundreds of years all over the world kind of thing. Because the British Empire is like the last global superpower before the United States. And it has so many similarities to the United States, aside from just, you know, the same language, that it's incredible to me that Americans in general aren't as interested and that they aren't more interested and more knowledgeable about British Empire history than they are. Most Americans know very little about it and don't seem to have a whole lot of curiosity. And so this is going to be one of those cases, which I've done with a few of my episodes and miniseries, where I'll do a topic that listeners are making clear they want, like the Civil War was that way, or Woodrow Wilson was that way. I had a lot of listeners really kind of nudging me for that one. But every now and then I'll drop something that like no one's asking for, and I'm pulling more of like a Steve Jobs, where it's like, you don't know that you want this, but I know that you do. And I know that if I make it, you'll actually appreciate it. And some of the episodes and things I've done that have been more like that have become like, for lack of a better term, cult classic episodes, mm-hmm. where I'll hear from listeners going like, I had no idea that would be interesting, but I listened to it and it's one of my favorite episodes. Like I did a two-part series that I called, I think, Rise of the Cain Kingdom. And it was about the creation, largely through government intervention in both the environment and the economy, the creation of the sugar industry in Florida, which really shouldn't be there. If there was a free market and free trade and there wasn't government doing things like draining the Everglades to create agriculture land and things like that, there would be no sugar growing in Florida. It wouldn't make any sense. And the big sugar growers in Florida are some of the biggest agricultural corporation welfare queens around. And so I actually covered, and I did an episode also connected to that called Draining the Swamp, that was just all about how the federal government ruined the Everglades.
Interesting.
And not the Draining the Swamp we all think about now.
Right.
And those episodes, I mean, I'm dealing with like environmental history and agricultural and economic history of Florida. And yet I hear from people all over the world saying that those are actually on their short lists of some of their favorite episodes that I've done. So, maybe the British Empire will end up being like that too, you know, right. where people will like it and didn't even realize they wanted it.
Well, that pattern of the government screwing up some type of the market and then overcorrecting and subsidizing and even is such a common story. I'm sure that people in all sorts of countries are seeing that, oh, the drain, the Everglades, oh, yeah, well, you know, that's exactly like what happened over here in this local, you know, whatever market the government screwed things up. And isn't it true that still today, the sugar prices are artificially elevated because of government influence, and that's why we have so much of this high fructose corn syrup in our food.
Yeah. The policies, and I actually got into that in those episodes, that the policies of the Department of Agriculture result in sugar being artificially expensive relative to high fructose corn syrup, and this is why in America high fructose corn syrup is so widely used in everything, and in most of the rest of the world high fructose corn syrup is used little if at all, and regular sugar is in everything. And as terrible as regular cane sugar is for you, high fructose corn syrup seems to be even worse. So and it's also why, you know, sodas and desserts and whatever will often taste better if you're in another country. Like right. the Coke tastes better in Mexico than it does in America and things like that. But I also made the analogy in the episode dealing with the Everglades that when you look at the way the U.S. government, mostly via the Army Corps of Engineers, intervened in the Everglades as an ecosystem over the course of the 20th century, it's very similar to the whole Mises idea of like each intervention leads to future interventions, supposedly to correct all of the problems created by the prior intervention, right? And so that's what you see in the environmental history of the Everglades, is like each time that the government does something to alter the natural ecosystem and balance of the Everglades, it creates all these secondary and tertiary problems. And then the answer is, well, now we need to intervene into the environment these other ways. And of course, it's sort of like gradually going to socialism, because you end up in a situation where the Everglades today is largely a completely artificially controlled ecosystem, where it's like all these dams and canals and locks and things operated by the Army Corps of Engineers is controlling all the water flow and everything like that. And just like with the government central planning the economy, they're never going to get it right. You know, there's right. always going to be either drought or flood, or there's going to be wildfires, or there's going to be some other disaster, because you can't just plan something as complicated as a giant ecosystem, just like you can't plan something as large and complex as a nation's economy.
Or a response to a coronavirus.
Yeah, that too.
You don't know. Yeah, and also elements of the road to serfdom, where, you know, a bureaucracy has started to do something. They don't do a very good job, so you have to increase the size of the bureaucracy. And the more that you increase the size of bureaucracy, the more it's going to be uncontrollable, until you then people are demanding, you know, one overlord to cut through all the red tape. And, you know, you get into those situations where, you know, you have this more and more concentrated power.
Sure.
So, well, Professor CJ, it's been a delight. It's been about a half an hour, and I could just keep chatting with you, but I promise I'd keep it for about a half an hour. And so I really want everybody to check out the Dangerous History podcast, really dig down into that back catalog as well. And the Woodrow Wilson series. If you want to know, did Woodrow Wilson have a crush on his first cousin? I'll leave that up to you guys to discover.
Yeah, he's pretty creepy. He's in like Joe Biden territory as far as just overall creepiness, I think.
Yeah. Just who knows what kind of whose hair he was sniffing back then, but they just didn't have video of.
Exactly.
So anything else you'd like to plug, or any specific episodes that you think would be really great for people to start off on?
No, just go to dangeroushistorypodcast.com, and that'll take you to the basic homepage for my show. And it's available on all the usual podcast syndication venues, iTunes, Stitcher, et cetera, et cetera. And yeah, you can just browse through and jump in wherever you want to. Some of the most popular series overall have been my American Revolution series, which has quite a following, even though it's pretty old and my production quality wasn't so good back then, but I still stand by the overall content though. And also my Civil War series, that's a little bit more recent, and that's, you know, if you want to drive from like Miami to Anchorage, Alaska, and listen to history podcasts the whole way, go jump into my Civil War series, or jump into the Wilson series that I'm currently only a little bit of the way into. But yeah, check it out. I think if you listen to this show, that you're probably the type of person who would be really receptive to the sorts of things I cover in history.
Excellent. And with that, we'll close. This is going to be episode 17, honoringronpaul.com/EP17, EP17. So this is Howard Grattan from the future. Since I recorded this with Professor CJ, he released a Daylight Savings Time episode about the history and all the destruction that Daylight Savings Time has caused. I think that would be a great one to listen to as a primer, and then dig into some of his longer series, if you like what you hear.